Case for argument is Ebert v. Goetz. Mr. Clavelli.
Charming people, the defendants in this case. The gang in this case, the murder of those people. That was particularly ugly, didn't you think?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, yes.
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Clavel.
You've cleared the court, Mr. Clavel.
Your Honor. Distinguished counsel, state. It's an honor to present this argument on behalf of Mr. Ebert. He has had a long struggle in an attempt to show that he is actually not guilty of these offenses. That, of course, is not the issue before the court today. The issue before the court today is whether he had a fair trial, which an effective counsel is to ensure.
But what happened to Maynard in English?
English was not prosecuted, and Maynard, of course, was found guilty because the evidence against him was overwhelming. Sharon Braster, which is part of the record in this case, testified that, you know, he came down covered with blood and said, I killed these guys and I...
So what was his sentence?
Natural life. Natural life.
English was not prosecuted? That's
English filed another motion because he was taken from a hospital where he was admitted as an alcoholic. And the only evidence against English came from Maynard, who went before a grand jury and said, English confided in me that he did it.
Oh.
So they had actually no evidence against English, except the fact he was seen by the two children going up the stairs to the victim's apartment with Maynard. The only one that they had no evidence against was...
Didn't Ebert's confession mention English?
I don't recall if it did or not, but Ebert's confession had several elements that were physically wrong. And Ebert's confession, of course, was the only basis, as the appellate court has admitted, both appellate courts, for the conviction. It was virtually all the evidence. And the first appellate court came right out and said the observation by Sharon Brasher after Maynard changes his clothes, takes a shower, gets the blood wiped off, goes outside, and there's John Ebert calling upstairs to the deceased people, let me in, let me in. And, of course, he was not covered with blood. He also had an alibi that was virtually foolproof, which the appellate court also mentioned. And so the appellate court of Illinois puts it right on the trial counsel. He didn't interview Sharon Brasher or her two children. And even after the first opinion and after the first trial, he still didn't interview Sharon Brasher and the two children. And, of course, Sharon Brasher would have confirmed what the PD's investigators had learned from Dolores Esparza, that the overheard conversation was not about a murder. Because Sharon Brasher was at that conversation. She was a participant, and yet she never testified anything about that conversation, which would have been evidence at Maynard's trial and evidence at Ebert's trial. So the finding of probable cause was based on false evidence.
But I think your most serious problem is that even if the lawyer had tried to get the confession excluded as the fruit of an illegal arrest, I think there was probable cause for the arrest. So that his
was woefully lacking. It was woefully lacking. There were only two items, as pointed out. The so-called citizen informant, Michael, who merely repeated what was given to him by Maynard. So when you look at the test established by this court, did he have firsthand knowledge? No. Did he provide details? No. Were the details corroborated? No. And did he testify at the preliminary hearing? No. So that, and the fact that it came from Maynard, the appellate court of Illinois credited when Lee versus Illinois says it is presumptively unreliable. So the Illinois appellate court had the facts wrong, and they also had the law wrong. They did not apply the law correctly. But the fault really lies at the foot of the lawyer, and he admitted it in his post-trial motion that he should have interviewed these people. There was no reason, especially when the first appellate court reverses the case because of incompetence of counsel. How can you not then examine the pathetic job he did at the motion to suppress? Dolores Esparza's statement came in. They didn't even know Dolores Esparza existed. There was no police report. So when your honors look at the two statements, which are in the separate appendix, prepared after the interviews of Dolores Esparza, they both follow after the conduct of the motion to suppress. The defense didn't even know she existed at the time of the motion to suppress. And according to the arresting police officers, her interview, unrecorded, was the reason they arrested Ebert, not Michael Brasher's statement. He only gave a statement after his mother was arrested. Ebert was already in custody on May 1st, 1992. So, and the state of Illinois would not have even relied on that evidence again, because by this time they've spoken to Sharon Brasher, and they know that that conversation did not have anything to do with killing anybody, which is consistent with what Dolores Esparza would have said, that the conversation was not about murdered people.
I don't believe that.
I beg your pardon?
That they're just having a conversation about pigs.
Judge, Sharon Brasher testified at both Maynard and Ebert's trial.
Stick. These people aren't talking about pigs.
First of all, it wasn't even established that Ebert was present.
That's a different issue.
But had Sharon Brasher been asked, let's say trial counsel interviewed Sharon Brasher, were you present at a conversation? Was John Ebert there? He didn't even do that. Your Honor, the evidence for probable cause is as weak as it was in Owens, United States versus Owens. In my opinion, it was not even a close call. And for the second appellate court to rely on the law of the case when the first appellate court was so strong in its condemnation of counsel's ineffective performance, really cannot be overlooked by this court.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Covelli. Mr. Blankenheim?
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Michael Blankenheim on behalf of the respondent. This court should affirm the judgment denying habeas relief because the Illinois Appellate Court reasonably rejected petitioner's claim that trial counsel was ineffective when he did not file a motion to suppress before petitioner's retrial.
You know, the facts surrounding Mrs. Spears' statement and what she did or did not say changed so significantly between the first suppression hearing and the second trial. Why wouldn't that fall under the law of the case exception, where facts presented in a subsequent proceeding are so substantially different as to require different interpretation? Of course, that's People versus Weinger, that Illinois appellate case from 1981.
Well, in this case, the appellate court didn't rely solely on the law of the case doctrine. The court mentioned that that doctrine applies when there's been a prior probable cause finding in a first appeal, but the court also mentioned the relevant exception, which is that finding will no longer be binding if there is a substantial difference between the facts as presented at the first hearing and at the second hearing. Here, the state appellate court reasonably concluded that the facts were not substantially different. And to follow up about the differences between Esparza's statements, all that's lost from the original statement to police in light of her post-suppression hearing statements is the fact that the conversation is expressly about a murder. In her statement, which can be found at separate Appendix G, the first statement, which is the one that she signs.
The first statement, the one on the basis of which the police arrested?
Yes, I mean, I was referring...
What's the relevance of her later statement?
In one of the later statements, she indicates that she...
What difference does it make? The police just have what she said the first time.
Yes, but in one of those statements, she mentions that I did not tell the police that the conversation was expressly about a murder. So that raises the question of what did the police know at the time.
So is the theory that if the lawyer had questioned her, she might have recanted at that point? Is that the idea?
That's the theory, yes. So to get back to your question, Judge Robner, the only difference is that the conversation is not explicitly about a murder. Dolores Esparza affirms in her April 13, 1993 statement that she overheard a conversation 1 week after the murders at which petitioner James Maynard and Sharon Brasher are present. And during that conversation, Maynard asks, "Do you all know how a pig bleeds when you slit his throat?" So although that conversation is no longer expressly about a murder, it's reasonable for police to look at that and say, well, that gives us some suspicion that they are, in fact, talking about the murder, especially when one of the victims in this case had his throat slit. And turning back to the state court's analysis, the state court was not objectively unreasonable when it held that a second motion to suppress had no reasonable probability of success. The probable cause standard is a low standard, requiring only a reasonable belief in guilt. And in this case, the police had James Maynard's statement identifying petitioner as one of three people who had stabbed the victims. James Maynard made that statement to Michael Brasher in a private conversation, and at a time when there was no reason to believe that James Maynard would think that Michael Brasher would be relaying those statements to police. Additionally, the remaining information that Michael Brasher supplied for probable cause demonstrated that he was a credible source. He implicated his mother in the concealment of the homicides. She had directed him to...
Right, if you implicate your mother, it means you're an honest citizen.
And, right. According to Michael, Sharon directed him to throw away James Maynard's bloody boots. And even though she had no money to give Michael the day before the murders, she surprisingly had $50 to give him the day after, with the caveat that he not ask any questions as to where the money came from. And of course, police knew that the victim's apartment had been robbed in this case. And to follow up on some of the questions earlier, I believe Robert English was prosecuted but acquitted. And if the court looks at our supplemental appendix 13 through pages 15, you'll see that Ebert's confession does put English at the scene. And to respond to counsel's point that the police should not have given any weight to James Maynard's statements, it's interesting that he relies on Lee versus Illinois, which is a Confrontation Clause case. Of course, the question in this case is, was there a reasonable ground for belief of guilt at the probable cause stage, which is a lesser standard, and of course hearsay can be used to establish probable cause. And finally, if the court will look at supplemental appendix, the petitioner separate appendix H at page A105, you'll see that one of the officers filled out a report about his conversation with Dolores Esparza. Although that report was not prepared contemporaneously with the interview, it was prepared within two weeks of the interview. Counsel also argues that the retrial counsel was ineffective for not interviewing Sharon Brasher and her children. He did not make that claim in state court, so we argue that that relief can be granted on that ground because of procedural default. He also does not cite anything in the record to in fact show that no interviews were conducted, and that should be a ground for forfeiture. And if the court has no further questions, I'd like to just discuss the state appellate court's determination on the performance ground. They determined that it was not objectively unreasonable for counsel not to file a motion to suppress given that there was a plausible reason for the motion not to be filed, and that is the motion's lack of merit. And now in determining if that was a reasonable application of Strickland, this court in Jackson versus Frank said that you can look to other decisions from other courts where a similar outcome is met on a similar set of facts. And that's this court's decision in Mason versus Godinez, which we rely on. The attorney in that case did not file a motion to suppress, and as a result, key evidence linking Mason to the robbery was admitted against him. If that was not unreasonable performance, the state appellate court here was not objectively unreasonable in rejecting the Strickland claim on performance grounds. If there are no further questions, we ask you to affirm the district court's judgment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Blankheim. So, Mr. Clavelli, I think his time expired. No, you have 2 minutes. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be brief. Your Honors, first of all, if you look at pages A103 to A105, the section of the record, the name Dolores Esparza is listed only as a person who was interviewed. The conversation is not contained in a report. The Illinois Appellate Court specifically says that in its first opinion. And the judge comments on it in the motion to suppress it's strange that there's no report giving her testimony. But it's not strange if she's telling the police, well, I didn't hear anything about any murders. Secondly, James Maynard, as pointed out in my brief, I believe at page 15, on April 24th, 1992, 1 week before the arrest of Maynard and Ebert, which was on May 1st, he goes in front of the Cook County Grand Jury and says, English did it all by himself. He confided in me. So Maynard, obviously, under Lee versus Illinois, his information he gave to Michael should have had no bearing at all. And I maintain, as the officer said,
he tried. Of course, he wants to make up something, wants to shift the blame to someone else. That doesn't cast doubt on the credibility of his original statement.
I believe it does, Judge. I believe it does. But that, of course, is for Your Honors to decide. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Clavelli and Mr. Blankenheim. And the court will stand in recess.